Angie has made it easier than ever to hire high-quality pros to get all your home service jobs done well. Just bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie will connect you with local pros who match your specific needs. Or book a service instantly at an upfront price. So join the millions of homeowners who use Angie to care for their homes and get your next home service job done well. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
The president has made clear that he is focused on ensuring that vaccines are accessible to every American. That is our focus.
With the U.S. focus at home, cash-strapped Cuba defies the odds to produce its own vaccine and ship it abroad. The soft power of vaccine diplomacy. Plus,
when I'm writing a novel, I want it to have an emotional connection with people. That's one of my great priorities.
Nobel Prize winner Kazuo Ishiguro talks about his new novel, Clara and the Sun, and how his own wife and daughter are his toughest critics. Then,
the average person, average family has really fallen behind, and this is our attempt to plug them back into the game.
Go big or go home. Democratic Congressman Tim Ryan tells our Michelle Martin why President Biden's massive COVID relief package meets America's moment. Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. Call it another shot in the arm for hope. New data here in the UK shows that a single dose of either the Oxford AstraZeneca or the Pfizer vaccine cut the risk of COVID hospitalization by more than 80%. Now, while the UK and Israel lead the pack in vaccine rollout, big, powerful blocs like the EU and the United States are still struggling with theirs. Meantime, other countries like Russia, China, India are all engaged in a type of vaccine diplomacy, whereby they are producing and exporting doses to poorer countries that are being left behind. Even the small island nation of Cuba is looking to help others. It may be racked by shortages of bread and even pain medication, but Cuba is on the cusp of a scientific breakthrough with its own Sovereign 2 COVID vaccine. As correspondent Patrick Opman reports, Cuba has been a biomedical pioneer for years.
Cuba hopes this is what the payoff looks like to a big gamble. Well, many other developing countries have competed with richer nations to import vaccines against the coronavirus, Cuba has been making its own vaccine. In March, two out of four potential vaccine candidates made in Cuba will begin their third and final trials. If the trials are successful, Cuba's would be the first vaccines developed in Latin America.
And the main objective of this clinical trial is to show the clinical efficacy of our vaccine candidate. After that, we could be in condition for start a massive immunization in Cuba or in some other countries of the world.
You believe that everybody in Cuba, the 11 million people who live here, could be vaccinated by the end of this year?
Yes.
Well, Cuba is only now just beginning to vaccinate people on a large scale as part of the third trial. Cuban scientists tell CNN they have already produced more than 300,000 doses of Sovereign 2, one of their vaccine candidates, and could eventually make millions more doses each month.
The pandemic has all but destroyed Cuba's economy. Beaches that usually would be full of tourists are now empty. The vaccine, though, could help change Cuba's fortunes, as researchers here say they can produce enough to sell overseas and even market vaccination vacations, offering the vaccine to tourists as a way to restart the Cuban tourism industry.
It may seem unbelievable that a poor island where there are shortages of food and basic medicines like painkillers and antibiotics can create a cutting-edge vaccine, but Cuba has produced its own vaccines going back decades. Cuban scientists say the same U.S. sanctions that isolated the island forced Cuba to become a biomedical pioneer. Cuba has been following established protocols and providing updates on their vaccine development international observers say. This is very good news, and we are following these results carefully, he said. First, because the Cuban population will directly benefit from their vaccine candidates, and this, at some point, could control the transmission in the country. Cuban scientists say the island likely could not afford to import vaccines from abroad and pursued multiple vaccine candidates in case some did not pass the trials. If Cuba ends up with more than one working vaccine, it could allow doctors a greater arsenal to wipe out the coronavirus here.
I also think that at the end we might be able to implement what we call prime and boost, which is using some vaccines for the first doses and then boostering or reimmunizing with a second vaccine candidate in order to enhance the previous immune response.
Iran is carrying out large-scale trials with Cuban vaccines, and Mexico is expected to begin trials. As the world struggles with vaccine shortages, other countries may be calling soon.
Patrick Ottman reporting from Havana there. And later in the program, we will talk to an expert about the Cuban progress in the biotech world. Now, we're going to take a trip into the future with celebrated author Kazuo Ishiguro, famed for his period drama The Remains of the Day, which won the Booker Prize back in 1989, and his best-selling dystopian novel Never Let Me Go. Ishiguro's new book, Clara and the Sun, is his first since winning the Nobel Prize for Literature in 2017. It is told through the eyes of a robotic artificial friend called Clara. She, or it, provides companionship to a girl called Josie, who's struggling with a mysterious illness after being gene edited or lifted. In our wide-ranging conversation, we spoke about what it is to be human and how his wife and daughter are tough but valued critics who made him rework parts of his latest novel. Here's my conversation earlier with Kazuo Ishiguro. So Kazuo Ishiguro, welcome to the program.
Very nice to be here.
So eagerly awaited, like every one of your books, Clara and the Sun, which is a beautiful, beautifully bound book, is your latest. It sort of continues some of your dystopian investigations into the human condition, and in this case, into the AI condition. Tell me what you were going for when you conceived this book.
It wasn't really intended to be a book about AI or indeed about gene editing. I mean, both of those things are in the kind of slightly dystopian backdrop. I wouldn't even call it dystopian. It's kind of on the turn. You know, it could go that way. Mm-hmm. It was really an investigation from the point of view of an AI into very specific things about the human heart and human relationships. And so... And in a way, the main character, Clara, she has more in common with, these characters you get in small children's books, a teddy bear or a doll or an animal. She's an outsider and she's looking at human life from a very specific angle. Because she's been created to keep teenagers from becoming too lonely, at the beginning, anyway, she sees humanity through the lens of loneliness. I mean, she's always asking people out there in the street, I mean, are they lonely? Are they behaving like that to avoid loneliness? And so that's how we start. And it's a kind of an investigation into human relationships and some particular questions. Yeah.
Just to be clear, Clara is the robot, and she is hired, acquired, bought by Josie's mother, as you say, to look after Josie, this kid. And you talk about gene editing. Obviously, the whole CRISPR revolution is you write about it. There are two different groups of human beings in your future here who are going to be lifted or unlifted. Tell me, which is better?
Well, I mean, I don't know which is better, but I mean, it's going to be very tough for people who aren't lifted. Now, I'm not necessarily saying that this is what's going to happen, but I mean, you mentioned CRISPR just now. I think it's a very exciting gene editing tool. I think it will bring us enormous benefits. I think a lot of the diseases, illnesses that we fear right now we won't fear nearly as much because of gene editing. However, I mean, it does open the way for using it for enhancement, just as we can use it to cure or make us immune from various kinds of disorders. In this book, the fear that is being expressed is of some sort of savage meritocracy that we would not be able to control between children who have been enhanced and children who haven't.
So let me read, because you talked a moment ago about you know, what does it mean to have a heart? And frankly, it is right on the back jacket cover. You said, "Do you believe in the human heart? I don't mean simply the organ, obviously. I'm speaking in the poetic sense, the human heart. Do you think there is such a thing, something that makes each of us special and individual?" What is the conclusion?
I don't present an actual clean conclusion, but I raise that question. In a world in which algorithms and data seem to be offering a kind of a solution to the human heart, or solving it, of actually mapping it out completely. When we live in this kind of world, will we actually start to regard ourselves differently to the way we have done for centuries? I mean, and it allows me to ask some of these older questions, like, you know, do we have a soul inside these kind of bodies? By virtue of which it makes sense to say that, you know, I love this particular individual, but I don't really like that one very much. Mm-hmm. Is there a uniqueness that we each possess that actually means something, or is a sense of our individual soul, you know, is that dissolving in the face of many of the things that are becoming normal with new technology, new science? So I'm looking at what's happening to a particular human family under those kinds of pressures.
So let me talk about your human family, because, you know, this book, and again, I'll read, is in memory of my mother, Shizuko Ishiguro, who she died in 2019. She was 92 years old, I think. And she was the first person that you called when you were told that you won the Nobel Prize. And she was very important in your life in terms of leading you to books and literature. Talk to me about that, because your early years, I think, were in Japan, right?
Yes, I came from Japan to Britain at the age of 5. No intention on the part of the family to settle permanently. We were always preparing to go back. So, you know, I remained quite Japanese within the home, but became rapidly British outside of it. And like a lot of boys when I was a teenager, I didn't do very much reading. I was very keen on listening to music and playing music. But my mother was a natural storyteller. She wasn't a literary person, but she was a very natural storyteller. And when she would very spontaneously go into telling stories, either about her own experiences in Japan or her growing up, or indeed she would act out, you know, scenes from books or Shakespeare plays. Mm-hmm. She was the person who introduced me to Dostoevsky for the first time when I was about 16 or 17. I didn't really want to read a gloomy looking book about Russians, but she persuaded me that it was actually about a student who was going out of his mind. And I thought that sounded much sexier, much more interesting. And Dostoevsky has remained probably my favorite author, and she's introduced me to many people. So I'd say she's very important, but she probably inhabits Clara and the Sun in another kind of way. You know, I think there is something about many mothers, many parents of both sexes, that reminds me of a kind of like a programmed robot when it comes to childcare. You know, we have a very, very strong desire to fulfill this goal, to do the best for our child, protect our child, come what may. And my mother was very much like this. And like many people of her generation, she gave up her profession to start a family. And everything she did, I had the impression, she had at the back of her mind, you know, would this bring her closer to the goal of doing something good for her children?
Right.
And so Clara is a bit like that. She literally has it programmed into her.
I also want to pick up on something that you've said about both Naomi, your daughter, and Lorna, your wife, about what fierce and constructive critics of your work they are. And I was fascinated to read how important they are to you, especially in the wake of winning the Nobel and winning the Booker and having so many awards and so many people, I mean, revere your work. And why is it important for them to have such a good critical eye on what you produce?
Well, the obvious thing is that, you know, the more my reputation rises, the less people are willing to give me frank comments about my writing. So it becomes more and more important that I have Lorna and now Naomi as fairly savage critics. When I say savage, they're not savage for the sake of it. But you have to understand about my wife. I mean, she was my girlfriend back in 1979 when I first started to write. I mean, when we first met, I was not a writer, you know. And so she saw the first attempts, and in her eyes, I'm still that person. I think this person who I'm not a famous writer. I'm just this person who reckons he can write. And so she hasn't changed in the way that she looks at anything I produce.
And didn't she famously throw out copious numbers of pages of one of your first drafts, basically saying, no, this just doesn't cut it yet?
Yeah, she did that with the last one, and actually with Clara and the Sun as well. I mean, I did months of extra work after I thought I'd finished it, after she told me, I have to work on this, and this. And then of course, my writer daughter got hold of it and gave me a huge pile of notes. So I thought I'd finished this novel in April 2019. I didn't hand it in until December 2019 because of these very tough people in my family that I have to get past. But I think that's okay. I mean, I think many people in all kinds of areas of artistic endeavor, I think often have people like this who are part of the team. You know, as a kind of a front thing, I just have my name. But, you know, I mean, Kazuo Ishiguro is the name of this kind of little team.
So let me ask you, because there's the imaginary world, the historical world, then there's the emotional world and the existential world. And the committee said about you, he, in novels of great emotional force, has uncovered the abyss beneath our illusory sense of connection with the world. Do you struggle with connection with the world, your place in the world? I mean, I've heard a lot of artists say that, you know, the concept of aloneness, the concept of death, the existential struggle is what fuels them and fuels their art.
Yeah, I mean, I really love that citation. I like particularly the stuff about emotional force, because that is so important to me. When I'm writing a novel, I want it to have an emotional connection with people. That's one of my great priorities, and it's also a priority of mine that it stays on the mind for a long time afterwards. The second part of that citation, I've been trying to unpack ever since they came out with it. I'm not entirely sure what it means, but I like it. I'm trying to aspire to it. Maybe it's something like what you say. I mean, that we have a kind of illusion of being connected to each other and to society to a greater extent than we really are. That's possible. And I think I do touch on that in Clara, as well as in other books, that there is something fundamentally lonely about human beings. Not just the everyday loneliness of not having, you know, friends around you or stuff like that, but even when you're surrounded day by day by family and loved ones, there is something about our very nature that makes us actually lonely. And it's something to do with the very complexity of our individual beings.
Obviously, for the last year, that's all anybody's been talking about. Everybody's in lockdown. Nobody quite has the same kind of connection that they had before. Your books could be said, certainly Remains of the Day and several others, including this one, Clara and the Sun, to be about an element of lockdown. And I just wonder how you survived lockdown emotionally, intellectually, spiritually.
Well, I mean, for me, it's relatively easy. You know, I have a very privileged, luxurious life where I'm not I'm not made to go outside and risk myself if I don't want to. I'm very comfortable. There are many, many people out there who aren't in that position. Now, I feel almost guilty about the way, how comfortable lockdown has been for me. But I have to say about the whole pandemic thing, I mean, I think the overwhelming thing that it has to, we have to recognize is the number of people who've died.
Yeah.
I think staggering number of people have died. There are millions of people right now bereaved, shocked, mourning somebody they've lost. I think that comes before everything else, before we start discussing what it tells us about, how society is moving on, or what, how it's speeded up technology, or how it's changing the high street. I think the huge, huge thing that we've got to face up to is just this staggering amount of death. We usually only get this kind of death when we have major wars. In Britain, we are double the death figure, civilian death figure of the Second World War now. And I think this is what's really going to hit us, the huge emotional impact. I'm just staggered by the amount of sorrow and misery that it's caused and is causing.
And rightly so, rightly so. So I want to ask you a final question on a slightly different topic. You are known to have guitars, and you are known to, I think, write some lyrics for certain musicians. And you're also known to admire and like Bob Dylan. So first I want to ask you about Bob Dylan winning the Nobel Prize for Literature. What did you think about that?
I was delighted. I mean, he won it the year before me. And I was delighted to go in his footsteps. Now the big question about this, his Nobel Prize, some people have said he deserved it because his lyrics are like poetry. In other words, you ignore everything else about what he does, put those lyrics down on the piece of paper, they're as good as, Keats or whatever. That's one argument. Now, I don't actually go for that. I like to think that the Nobel Prize was a recognition not just of Dylan, but of the art that he helped actually bring to a very high level in the 1960s and 1970s, which is the art of the singer-songwriter. Now, the Literature Prize actually includes, it recognizes, drama, poetry, fiction, usually, But I think, I'm hoping that it started to recognize this very important art form, which is a mixture of performance, literature, music, storytelling, which is the art of the singer-songwriter, as exemplified by Dylan. I don't think you can separate things like just his lyrics.
So how disappointed were you when you were both going to be awarded honorary degrees, I think, at St. Andrews University, and he didn't turn up at the last minute?
Yeah, that was a disappointment. That was back in 2003. I was told that only two people were going to receive this thing together, and it was going to be me and Bob Dylan. So off I went up to Scotland, very eager. And the idea of kind of being robed in some kind of strange costume in some back room with Bob Dylan and waiting to go on to take part in some kind of academic ceremony, I thought was pretty enticing. But he did actually go the following year. He cancelled at the last moment, but I was delighted because I found myself with Betty Boothroyd, the former Speaker of the House of Commons, and she was wonderful, and I was great. I was really honoured to receive a degree with her. And
the first female speaker, right?
Yes, I believe so. Yes, and yep, Yeah, I thought it was odd that we had a narrow miss for Stockholm as well. I mean, he was there 1 year, and I got it the next.
Yeah. Hey, yes. I'm going to think about that. Thank you so much for being with us, Sir Kazuo Ishiguro. And the novel Clara and the Sun is out, and it's bound to be a huge success like your other ones.
Thank you very much, Christian. Very nice to be with you.
Our conversation just ahead of publication of Clara and the Sun, which is today. Now, more now on our story about vaccine diplomacy, Cuban style. The small island nation just 93 miles off the coast of the United States developed its own COVID shot. It's called Sovereign 2, and it's set to share it with other countries. Cuba's remarkable achievement is now leading many to wonder what other medical advances it could offer the world. Candace Johnson is president and CEO of Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center in New York. She worked closely with Cuban scientists to bring their lung cancer vaccine to the U.S. for trials. And she is joining me now. Welcome to the program, Candace Johnson. So let me ask you, first, you know, everybody knows Cuba and the United States at loggerheads, diplomacy, you know, has been disrupted. There are sanctions. It can barely pay for its, you know, daily bread. And yet, over the decades, it's been really standout on the biomedical front. Why is that, do you think?
So, you know, Cuba has really distinguished itself in some of the most preeminent immunologists. These individuals are some of the brightest and most innovative scientists that I've had the pleasure to work with. And, you know, Cuba was sort of forced into this because they didn't have access to the drugs that you might get in Western countries. And so they developed the technologies to vaccinate their own people against a whole variety of things. We were obviously interested in their development of a lung cancer vaccine, but it is no surprise to me that they're on the forefront of a COVID vaccine. They're truly remarkable people.
So tell me, I mean, it sounds everybody's going to be pricking up their ears at the sound of a lung cancer vaccine.
Yes.
What exactly is it? Is it preventative? Is it therapeutic? And how have they been able to do it? And how have you been able to get it?
Yeah, well, you know, that's the genius of the Cuban scientists. So lung cancer, as we all know, there's some new and novel approaches out that can increase someone's survival, even in late stage disease. But lung cancer, most of the therapies, at least a number of years ago, were focused around this one growth factor receptor. And they didn't have access to any of those drugs. And so they hypothesized, I wonder if we could immunize people against this particular growth factor. And this growth factor, the lung cancer cells are addicted to this growth factor. And so when the growth factor is present, the tumor grows. If you could prevent the presence of that growth factor in the patient, perhaps the tumor would stop. And so the real genius of this is immunizing someone against a protein that's natural to their body is no easy task. And that's why, you know, I'm sure that's why their COVID vaccine was so successful, because they developed a technology to take that growth factor and conjugate it to a very unique protein and then immunize people against this growth factor. And lo and behold, they demonstrated that patients had a very strong immune response and developed and actually depleted the levels of this growth factor in these lung cancer patients. No growth factor, the tumors don't grow. It was genius. And they did studies in Cuba. They've done studies in South America. They actually had gone through phase 3 studies. These results were published actually in an American journal. Their rigor was just as rigorous as in the States. Many of these scientists presented these results at national meetings. We wanted to bring this vaccine to the United States. And so back in 2015, we started the procedure to do exactly that. And today, it took a while for us to do that. And today we have clinical trials open here at Roswell Park and also at a number of other institutions in New York State, and hope to open them in some other institutions around the country. And we've already validated some of the initial concepts about this drug.
And again, I think it's really extraordinary to hear you talk about that. When you talk about the immune factor, the growth protein, etc.,
yes.
Are you talking about immunotherapy, which we hear a lot about in trying to treat cancer these days?
Exactly. This is a form of immunotherapy. Anything that you use to stimulate the immune system is immunotherapy. And so this is just a different kind of immunotherapy. And one promise that we think Simavax, which is the name of this drug, may have is actually in prevention. So say you have lung cancer, it's very isolated, early stage disease. You can actually cut it out with surgery and remove it. But we know that those patients are at very high risk for recurrence. So you reduce the tumor burden, if you will, in the individual. You immunize them with Simivax. They have these circulating antibodies against this growth factor, and therefore they get no recurrence. And we actually think that this has great promise, and we're about to initiate a new trial to look at this in our patients. Very exciting.
And just to be clear, yes. Candace Johnson, is this the only source of this Simivax lung cancer therapy vaccine? Is it only from Cuba?
Only from Cuba. Yes, indeed.
Wow.
And I know the thing that is so remarkable is that Cuba does not have the Cuban scientists, who are in my mind innovative, brilliant. They're always thinking out of the box. They're always trying to think very innovatively. How can they solve a problem? They don't have the advantages that maybe we have in this country of fancy equipment, all these very expensive reagents. They actually have to use their head and figure out how to attack these problems. And they've been very successful at this. And so we're very excited to have this collaboration. As you could well imagine, during COVID, things have sort of been put on hold, but we're anxious to see COVID come to an end so we can continue our collaborations with these wonderful folks.
Yeah, and the COVID vaccine, the Sovereign 2, is, as we discussed, it's about to head into its final phase of trials. And then, as we said, they have said that they want to export it as well as immunizing their own people, clearly, and offering it as sort of tourist vaccine package holidays to Cuba as a way to reboost their shattered economy. You've been there a lot. I know you've been to Cuba. You've spoken to the scientists. You've looked through your, professional lens at what they're doing. Talk to me a little bit about their soft power in terms of vaccine diplomacy and medical diplomacy. Over the decades, they have exported this thing that they do so well.
Yes, they have. The science and especially applied science. So these immunologists very much are developing preventative measures for their citizens. They're always thinking about, it's purely for the good of their mankind. They want to export this knowledge and help other folks around the world, but their motives are really to help their citizens in the development of these vaccines. And so it was really, when you go to Cuba and you see the dedication of these scientists and you see how really innovative they are and what they do with much less than we do, even in my own institution, it really is, it's awe-inspiring, and we really treasure those relationships we have. And it's not, Simivax is a very interesting lung cancer vaccine, but there are other things that they have that we could avail ourselves here in this country, and we're going to hopefully be a conduit for some of those things as we go forward.
Like, give me one sneak peek of a major breakthrough that they might give you.
Well, they have another vaccine involving the use of the immune system that may have application in a wider variety of tumors than just lung cancer, and so we're going to explore that as well. They have a lot of innovative drugs that they're working on.
I everybody knows, and I'm going to do the cliche, I'm going to play the pictures of the old cars that they have been repairing and keeping on the road for decades. Many of them, old American cars. And I'm going to read you what the director of the Cuban neuroscience has said. Cubans are not only able to make old cars still work, they can manage to make old equipment work too. So as you've said, they've had to work with subpar, I guess, equipment, but nonetheless raising their game scientifically. And they've also been sending doctors, and we've got images of that too, during the COVID pandemic, to places like Italy. We've got pictures of them disembarking in Italy in the spring of this year when the pandemic was so bad. Can you just sort of wax philosophical, if you like, on
Yes.
You know, their role and Russia's role and China's role and India's role in trying to get this vital medicine to the countries that can't afford it. And we know from the figures that the rich countries have already bought up billions of doses of COVID vaccine, and the poorer countries in the developing world just don't have that access.
They do not. I mean, you know, if you look, if you would look at the Ebola outbreaks in Africa, who were the physicians that were there on the front lines? It was the Cuban physicians. So they're always there in those instances. And they did play a very important role in Italy. And I think they see their place. You know, we're all people. We're all here for the betterment of mankind. And I think the Cubans take it perhaps to an extra step because they're truly dedicated to try to help people, especially people that are suffering from devastating diseases.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this is a political question, but do you regret that they are targeted by your country, that, you know, the Obama administration did restore diplomatic ties, the Trump administration did not? I don't want you to talk politically. I just want to talk sort of scientifically and medically about, could you perhaps get more if it was a different political situation? Or is it because they are under such pressure, as we've kind of discussed, that they actually are so ingenious in this field?
Well, it's a very interesting question. And actually, throughout, you know, we started this, as you say, in the Obama administration and went through different presidents. But all the way through, regardless of who was sitting in the White House, we still managed to visit each other. We still managed to continue our collaborations. We had to be a little bit more inventive about how we did it, but we still managed to achieve and to be successful. And I think that it probably does go a little bit to the heart and soul of the Cuban scientists, and it makes them maybe a little bit more thinking outside the box because they have to because of the situation. Mm-hmm. But we try to just focus on developing these drugs to help Americans, and potentially we have things here in this country that could really benefit the Cuban people that they just have no access to. So we're hopeful that through these collaborations, we can be there for each other. We're all people here.
It's really an amazing medical success story and really an example, really, of humanitarian and medical diplomacy and bridge building. Candace Johnson, thank you so much for joining us. A really fascinating story. Now, the American Rescue Plan, which is the $1.9 trillion stimulus package to help those hit hardest by the pandemic, has passed the House of Representatives. The economic recovery package has been President Biden's top priority since he entered office. Democratic Congressman Tim Ryan voted for the plan. He also ran for president in 2020, and he's now eyeing a Senate run in 2022. Here he is talking with our Michelle Martin about his role in investigating the Capitol riot and the challenges ahead in the Senate for the COVID relief bill.
Thanks, Christian. Congressman Ryan, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
2 months ago, your workplace was invaded by an armed mob. You went through impeachment, and you know, now your workplace is still surrounded by barbed wire and fencing. And I was just wondering what the vibe was like. I mean, you still have certain members who are either minimizing what the experience was like or saying it wasn't that big of a deal, or are still in denial about who was actually responsible. And I just wonder how that affects the working relationships.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's not good. There's no real way to sugarcoat it. It's not good. There's not a good relationship, but because you either have members, I think, on the Republican side who in many ways were complicit, continued to try to incite what happened on January 6th, came right back to the Capitol after the insurrection and business as usual. And then you have people that look the other way, which, you know, is aiding and abetting just you know, through their inaction, through acts of omission instead of acts of commission. And that's frustrating because it gets hard to try to have a working relationship with those people. And, you know, there's a lot of denial in the Republican Party right now, and that makes it difficult to try to work with them.
I wanted to point out that you are heading one of the committees that's actually investigating the riot, because you're the chair of the subcommittee that has authorization over the Capitol Police. So you're looking into that part of it. And I just wanted to, you know, you just had a hearing a couple of days ago. Have you learned anything?
Well, we learned that the threats are ongoing, that there's still a lot of chatter about, you know, taking over the Capitol and assassinating politicians and those kinds of things, which is obviously deeply troubling for members of Congress, their families, their friends, their staff, our staff. So that's you know, been difficult. But we're also moving forward with what we're going to do to protect the Capitol and to protect members of Congress. So we're gathering that information. We're working very closely with General Honoré, who is putting the strategy together for us on how we move forward. So, you know, we're just trying to piece it all together right now.
There was evidence presented at the hearing that the Capitol Police leadership did try to get additional help. And, you know, whether they asked soon enough, whether they took it seriously enough, that's all the part of what you're trying to sort out. But there is evidence that they called for additional help and they were denied, in part because the Pentagon political appointees there did not want that to go forward. The point of view of the Capitol Police who testified was that they didn't want the optics of sending the National Guard in to confront people they perceive as their supporters. But those people are gone now. And now, if that's the case, what do you do about that?
Well, I think you try to figure out what's a better chain of command. And again, look, we were dealing with leadership from the executive branch that we've never seen before in the history of this country. So it was a very unique situation where the president incited these folks to go down to the Capitol, said he was going to go join them, and all the things that you all have reported on that everybody knows had been going on through December and January to lead to this. So I think from a information flow standpoint, command and control standpoint, there may be some other ways we need to look at this. But look, in my estimation, this rests at the sergeant at arms who kept denying the request from the Capitol Police. And then I think the Capitol Police is to blame as well, the leadership, because they didn't push hard enough. I mean, if you kept asking for more National Guard, we need another, you know, not hundreds, but probably thousands of troops, and they weren't giving them to you, you needed to raise holy hell about it, because we were relying on you. And I had a call with the chief of police and the sergeant at arms the night before, and it was a bunch of happy talk that we're covered. Everything's fine. Now, they should have come to me as chair of the committee. They should have come to other members of Congress who oversee this stuff and say, look, we have a real problem. The sergeant at arms, they didn't even bring this request to the Capitol Police board for an official vote. The chief of police should have pushed for that, said, at least give me a vote so I'm off the hook here. And we get the board to approve or disapprove of it. So there's a lot of mistakes all in the leadership. The rank and file did everything that they were asked for, and they were really exposed to a lot of danger because of the lack of preparation. So within the reforms, we've got to make sure that the chain of command, the Capitol Police Board, and if there's any approval needed from the Department of Defense, that's very transparent and teed up and ready to go as well.
So let's turn around and turn our attention to the COVID relief bill that was passed by the House over the weekend. It's a big bill, you know, $1.9 trillion, wide ranging. There's money for unemployment benefits. There's money for improving school infrastructure, for COVID testing, for buying PPE. There are provisions for, you know, childcare. You know, it's just way too comprehensive for us to go into all the details here. So I just want to ask you, what do you think are the most important elements of the bill?
Well, taking care of the economic situation in the country. So the extension of unemployment until September is really going to give a lot of breathing room to millions of Americans who just can't find work. The jobs aren't available. The help for rent and utilities so people don't lose their homes. The $1,400 payment to help people kind of weather the storm a little bit here. Those are really the critical pieces of this entire thing, because it takes care of in making sure that people don't go bankrupt, make sure they don't destroy their credit. Because if you're a working class person, you destroy your credit, it could take you 10, 15 years to climb out of that. And so we want to prevent that from happening, because if we're going to have a robust recovery, then it's going to mean people are economically secure. They're able to go back to work and they got a few bucks in their pocket to go out and spend at those restaurants who have been crippled. You know, we're going to need people to go back out to dinner and out to the bars and out to the venues and keep those places going. And then the schools and the local governments are also going to get a good shot in the arm with this thing. And these communities need to get rebuilt. So we're going to come out of this thing, I think, potentially a lot stronger than we went in, because these communities are going to have some money and hopefully we can get a little wind at our back with the economy.
Is the number right? I mean, you're already hearing, not just to mention Republicans saying just the number's too big, but there are even some Democrats in the Senate that are saying the number is just too big. Where are you on that?
I think it's just fine. I think 1.9 trillion is a good number. It's a solid number. I'm old enough and got enough gray hair that I was around in 2009 when we did a stimulus bill. And at the time I was saying it wasn't big enough. And the economy dragged on, slow recovery around wages, around workforce and unemployment just dragged on. And because we didn't make that initial investment robust enough, we're not going to make that same mistake here. And I think this is a good number that's going to be a good shot in the arm for the economy and is going to allow us to have the kind of recovery that the American people expect us to have.
So the two schools of thought seem to be, as I understand it, that look, let's say you had a flood and all your kitchen was damaged, all your appliances were damaged. The two schools of thought seem to be, on the one hand, fix what was broken, right? The appliances are what's damaged. What's damaged is that. Focus on that. The other school of thought seems to be, why don't you fix what you didn't like to begin with? So how do you argue that point?
Well, the whole idea here is to help the economy for everybody. And this is an opportunity. It's about public health for sure. It's about vaccinations and testing and all of those things. But it's also about an economic recovery that everyone can share in that recovery. And those are the investments that are included in here. And I think they're in hand and glove. I mean, I just don't see those as separate, because the idea really is, how do we have an economy that can thrive post-pandemic and communities that can thrive post-pandemic? And yeah, the pandemic did some damage, but there was a heck of a lot of damage before the pandemic ever hit. And this is an opportunity for us to plug these communities in, clean these communities up, and allow them to participate in the growth that's going to come. So the bigger strategy is, if you take a step back, is hopefully after this, we have a robust infrastructure bill where we really start rebuilding the country. I mean, our country needs rebuilt: water lines, sewer lines, roads, bridges, schools, infrastructure, ports, blah, on and on and on. So this is a first step into that by getting money to the local communities. I think it's a first step in a broader package to rebuild the United States of America, which is what Joe Biden promised he would do. And in the COVID bill here is a down payment to make sure that every community can participate in that. And this has been 30 years. I mean, I just get a kick out of these, you know, folks who are saying like this, you know, this has nothing to do with the pandemic. It's like, okay, we've got communities that have been completely left behind by globalization, by automation, you know, by inequality, by terrible trade and tax policies that left people behind, and the government had absolutely no response to help them. Now we're trying to take steps to repair that. And this COVID bill is an opportunity to take that first step.
And the $15 minimum wage, what's going to happen there?
Well, the parliamentarian in the Senate has ruled that it is not germane to the reconciliation process. So we will come back and I think at some point have a vote on a $15 minimum wage that we scale up. I do think we have to be sensitive to what small businesses are going through in the middle of a pandemic. So we've got to do this over time. But if the minimum wage was indexed for inflation since 1968, it would be at $22 an hour. You know, so people, the average person, average family has really fallen behind. And this is our attempt to plug them back into the game.
Well, but the bill would scale it up. So the question I think for some people is, where's the spine of the Democrats? You know, when the Republicans didn't like the ruling of the Senate parliamentarian, they used their authority to replace the parliamentarian. The other alternative is the vice president could use her vote to ignore that ruling. And some people look at that and say that that's just an excuse not to do it. What do you say? Is that true? Is it an excuse not to do it?
Well, you're asking me to understand the Senate, the trickeries that happen over there. And I just don't. I agree. We need to push as hard as we can for this. I would hope that even if it's not germane to this particular procedure, that we should immediately bring it back and have a vote. It's supported by 60% of the American people. I think if you do it in the appropriate way that allows for businesses to roll in, I think even small businesses will begin to absorb it. Because here's the thing. If Walmart starts paying $15 an hour, the mom and pop shop up the street, who may have a handful of employees that they now have to pay $15 an hour, there's going to be a hell of a lot more consumers that have a lot more money in their pocket that can go to the mom and pop shop. So this is basic demand side economics that I think will be good for smaller businesses in the long run.
Well, but the other side of it, of course, is that the argument is that this advantages the employed at the expense of the unemployed, and that people, it doesn't do anything for job creation per se, that it puts more money into the pockets of people who are employed, but it doesn't do anything, as you pointed out, with small businesses who may have only a handful of employees to begin with. It doesn't give them any way or any room to sort of add more people. And if that's the bigger crisis right now, when you've got at least 10 million people unemployed, people say that's probably actually more than that. How does that help them?
Well, I think if more people have more money in their pocket, the people who are unemployed or the people who are employed who now are making more money, they now have more money to spend. People who are making $15 an hour pretty much spend everything they have. There's not a whole lot of savings there, but they're going to go from 10 or 11 bucks an hour to 13, 14 or 15 over time. That's more money that they have to go out and spend in the economy, which will increase demand, which will increase employment over time. And I think that's the appropriate thing for us to do. But again, you know, this is not our, I don't think the Democratic economic policy can come down to we're just for an increase in the minimum wage. We need to have robust investments into infrastructure. We need to make sure that we are going hard for building electric vehicles, building batteries, building charging stations, really dominating the new economy. That's where the significant jobs are going to be created. And we've got to have a focus on that, because those jobs pay 20, 25, 30 bucks an hour. And that's where we need to be. We're talking about the minimum wage. And I think what Joe Biden and his team want to do is rebuild that middle class around those industries of the future that can really pay. And that's in addition to the increase in the minimum wage.
But for some people, I think that the minimum wage is more of a sort of a metaphor for the Democrats' willingness to really fight for things that they believe in or that they say they believe in. And you can disagree with the Republicans in what they believe in, but where the argument goes, at least they're willing to fight for it to the mat. They're willing to take it to the mat. I mean, and do you think that that's true? I mean, some people say that that's the problem here. You think that's true?
Well, again, I don't understand the inner workings of the United States Senate, but if we're going to hold up the COVID relief bill, which has unemployment and all those other things that we talked about, and that's going to get held up while people are in the coming days are going to lose their unemployment benefits, you know, what's fair, you know? So, I mean, we've got to get this package out the door, and because it is going to help millions of people who are unemployed and may miss their rent payment and may destroy their credit and on and on. So we've got to get this out the door. I mean, it's frustrating in Washington because you got all of these issues coming at you at the same time. And while I am an advocate for the $15 minimum wage, let's bring it back up. You know, there's no reason why we shouldn't be able to pass the increase in the minimum wage. And if we've got to get the COVID package out the door and come back to do it, we control the House, we control the Senate, we have the White House. There should be no excuse for us to bring that back. And so let's help everybody. But the most timely thing right now is to help these people who are unemployed.
So you've said several times that you don't understand the inner workings of the Senate. Would you like to understand those advocacy coming up?
I'm interested in the inner workings of the Senate and learning more about it. Yeah, there's an open seat in Ohio, and we're looking very, very closely at it. It's, you know, I think another working class voice in the United States Senate is needed. You mentioned the issue of minimum wage, but the middle class, healthcare. You know, there's a lot of communities that have been forgotten in this country, and a lot of people that have been forgotten. The country hasn't been great to them. And I really take a lot of pride in giving some voice to those people. And so we're looking very closely to, you know, potentially do that on the floor of the United States Senate. I think that voice is missing. So we're going to look real closely at it.
Congressman Ryan, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thanks for having me.
Sounded like a yes. And finally, we spoke earlier about the success of the COVID-19 vaccines. I got one today and I feel great, and I hope all of you will soon as well. And also take up the offer when it's made. It is safe, as we reported earlier. It cuts the risk of hospitalization by more than 80%. And now comes news that the same breakthrough technology could unlock new treatments for a range of deadly diseases like malaria, which is a leading killer, including of children around the world. Reports say that researchers may have cracked the code on a malaria vaccine using an RNA-based approach similar to the Pfizer and the Moderna COVID-19 models. And scientists are working on more RNA-based cures for diseases ranging from cancer to sickle cell to HIV, which means the pandemic may ultimately help save more lives than it ever took. And wouldn't that be the silver lining to all of this suffering? That's it for now. You can always catch us online, on our podcast, and across social media. Thank you for watching, and goodbye from London.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN Flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country. Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.